Blog Talk Radio.
Good God, what was that?
A giant, hairy creature, part ape, part man. Indians call him Sasquatch. They believe he is as gentle as he is powerful and mysterious.
And welcome to Georgia Bigfoot Radio. I'm your host, Dan Miller.
All right, and good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you for tuning in tonight. I am your host, Dan Miller, with Georgia Bigfoot Radio. I have a fantastic and excellent guest again tonight. I have the one and the only Mr. David Bacara from Expedition Bigfoot, which is the fantastic museum up there in Cherry Log, Georgia. Before we get to our guest, again, just like I do in the other shows, just a few announcements, and then we'll get to our guest. I want to remind everybody that if you have a few seconds to spare, please go to the Georgia Bigfoot Radio Facebook page and give it a like. Also, it is completely voluntary. You don't have to do this if you don't want to, but there is a link to a Georgia Bigfoot Radio GoFundMe page, and there is a small cost to having the show every month. And so if you wish to donate, feel free to. All proceeds go towards the show. And, of course, that is not required, strictly donations. And, of course, we thank you for those. Let's see, what else? If you've had an encounter or you would like to be on the show, again, go to the Georgia Bigfoot Radio Facebook page. Click the button that says send a message, and be sure to leave your name and number within your message so that I'll know how to contact you, and we'll go from there. All right, ladies and gentlemen, I do have a couple messages that we'll go over first before we get to our guest. This first email comes from Michael, and Michael says, I also am very interested in knowing more about the Dyatlov incident. Oh, that's interesting. You know, Michael, if you're listening tonight, just before we came on air, our guest tonight, him and I were actually discussing that incident. And I'm going to pretty much make this a homework project of mine. I'm going to take the time to kind of do a better outline of some of the evidence that has been found, coupled with a better timeline of events that happened to those young students, and present it to you in another show. So just be patient. I'm putting all that together, and we may even discuss that a little bit tonight. Anyway, the next message comes from Karen. Hello, Karen. Thanks for listening to Georgia Bigfoot Radio. Karen says, I too am a follower of the Missing 411 series. Is there any chance you will get David Paulides on your show? Well, Karen, as I've said in previous shows, I will try. I'm pretty much a small, just local podcast, and he's doing conferences with, you know, 2, 5, 10,000 people sitting in the seats. So I'm not quite sure if he'll take the time to come on my little show here, but I'll certainly send him a message and see if we can get him on. As I have said in previous episodes, there's a lot more to talk about the Missing 411 series. I too have read 2 out of his 6 books, specifically 2 out of the 4 books dealing with missing persons cases in national parks. But we'll dedicate other shows to that topic as well. So please stay tuned. All right. Okay, so with no further ado, let's go ahead and talk to our guest. Once again, we have from Expedition Bigfoot in Cherry Log, Georgia, Mr. David Bacara. David, welcome to the show.
Hi, Dan. Thanks for having me.
All right. I can't remember if this is the right terminology or not, but you're basically the, I want to say the owner, but you're either, you're the curator, or are those two the same thing?
I don't think they're the same thing. I do both in this instance. I'm the owner
okay.
and then the curator.
All right. Fantastic. You know, David, in the show that I did 3 episodes ago, I issued a huge apology because for those of you listening, David was kind enough to grant me a 5-minute interview. And that same day was when Bob Gimlin was visiting Expedition Bigfoot. And he was kind enough to give me an interview with just a few questions that I asked him. And later on that evening when I got home and I was doing some editing, my dumb tech butt ended up deleting both interviews. So I'm so sorry about that. So it's obvious that the host of Georgia Bigfoot Radio is not very tech savvy. So forgive me. But anyway, so using that as kind of an intro, that was a fantastic day having Mr. Gimlin up there, David.
It was.
And
it was nice having him up there. He had some nice friends with him. Tom Cantrell, Arlo Williams, and Keith Bearden joined him also. And people, I never got a chance to meet the gentleman, but everybody that had met him before I did and that I had talked to all told me the same thing. What a gentleman. What a great guy. Just real old school, very approachable, and boy was he ever. He took his time with every single guest that waited in line for 2 hours to talk to him and shake his hand, and he really impressed me. What a great guy.
Yeah, I couldn't have said that better myself. I agree. He was so nice, and he even took the time. Even people waiting in line behind me said, hey, you know, if you're doing some sort of interview with him, go ahead and ask him the questions. And then when I got there to meet him, he said, go ahead and ask me a few questions. I don't mind answering them. And that was fantastic. And the one thing that will always stick out in my mind, David, is that I said, you know, Mr. Gimlin, I said, next year in 2017, your and Roger's footage turns 50 years old. And I said, in those 50 years, in spite of all the technological advances that have come along through those 5 decades, your footage remains one of the best, if not the best. And he said, you know, Dan, he says, that is something that will always be in the deepest part of my heart. And I thought that was just a great response to that.
Yeah. It's real amazing to think, God, you just hit the nail right ahead. All the technology, game cameras, FLIR thermals, helicopters, drones, oh my God, all incredible camera traps, people out there with cell phones that here it is 50 years ago, and they managed to catch it totally surprised. Didn't even know it was going to be there. They weren't sitting and hunting. They were riding horses and came across this thing and then filmed it on a rented, I think it was a 16-millimeter camera, on a rented camera.
Mm-hmm.
So you talk about just absolute 1 in a million chance, and these guys were paired, had the camera ready to go. It wasn't like stuffed down at the bottom of a backpack and they had to dig it out. It's just amazing that it all worked out that way, and here we are. We have the best footage in the whole world turning 50 years old.
Yeah, amazing, amazing. So now let's talk about you. First of all, let's talk about you a little bit, David. I don't know anything about your background as far as the studying of this great phenomenon known as Bigfoot. Did you have an experience when you were young, or is this something that has come on in recent years? Or so what started the pathway to the museum that we have today?
When I was about 12 years old, my brother and I went to go see a little movie at the theater called The Legend of Boggy Creek. and I think before that, I had read a few little articles about Bigfoot, maybe in school or something. And we went to go see that movie. And then the tagline, based on a true story, as you're watching this docudrama, they're telling you, you know, when it was the date and when it happened and how many people were there. And I think it, when we left, it really affected my, me and my brother to think that these, my brother and I were always outside kids. We were always outside playing. So I think it really, really affected us to think that we were always out in the woods and these things were out there. And it really affected us ever since I was 12 years old. I just consumed every article, every book, every TV show, documentary, movie, anything that had Bigfoot in it. I read it. People, my friends would know I was interested, so that if they came across something, they'd cut it out of a newspaper and send it to me. So, yeah, and then I had an opportunity to go on my first BFRO expedition about 6 years ago, and I was asked to become an investigator after that expedition. So I started doing reports, I guess, about 6 years ago. And then you really speed up learning fast when you're actually standing in front of people. You can read a lot of stories and books, but when you're standing in front of people, firemen, police officers, city commissioners, retired nurses, retired Navy jet pilots, you spend almost every weekend talking to somebody that's telling you what they saw up close. It really starts to affect you in a different way than just reading a story. When you see this guy telling you, and you see the emotion, you see his wife, you know, kicking in, going, "Yeah, remember it ran across and set the, oh yeah, that's right, I forgot to set the security light off," and all. It's just, they're just telling you exactly what they saw. So the story really takes a life of its own when somebody's standing in front of you telling you first person what they saw. And when you do one after another and after another, it really starts to solidify the interest in you. And you know, once you get into this, you can never get out again unless you have some kind of head injury. Forget who you are.
Boy, that's a good way to put it. I tell you, yep. I tell you, David, you really touched on something that means a lot to me, because I'm almost 50 years old. Okay, which means that I was a child of the 70s. Now, for anybody out there listening, most people that study this phenomenon, like David, like myself, when you meet guys around my age, we basically say the same thing. And I think that's a good thing, because it's really incredible. I remember specifically, David, that I came across a movie called The Legend of Boggy Creek. It affected me to such a point that I was scared, and I had become scared and obsessed all at the same time. Because after that, I started, and I don't know, and this is where I got lucky. I don't know why, but I went to grade school in a small little upstate New York town. And for some odd reason, there was an entire bookshelf, an entire bookcase, not just one shelf, but an entire bookcase of books dedicated to phenomenon, UFOs, Loch Ness Monster, Bigfoot, and a couple other things, aliens, whatever. And it was the Bigfoot ones that captivated me the most. And I one of them was one of those early books by John Green, and I probably read those books, I'd say, about 20 times over. And I hate to admit this, but I was a kid who didn't like to read. But I read those Bigfoot books probably 20 times, coupled with, of course, you know, the Legend of Boggy Creek. Then you've got the Leonard Nimoy episode of Bigfoot in the late 70s that caused a big ruckus because it was so popular and wanted to be watched over and over again. And it's almost like there's a template pathway established. Guys around our age, you know, say the same thing. I saw the Boggy Creek movie when I was a kid, and then I read these books, and then I started, when as I got older and I was on my own, I started going out into the field, and here we are. And it's, you know, whenever I hear what you had said about seeing the movie and then talking to people, I know exactly what you're talking about, and I can identify with that because I went through the same thing, and that's what has led me up to this point. Especially when you do start talking to people, you know, I got to tell you, David, I talked to a person who sent me a message on the Georgia Bigfoot Radio, did not want to come on the air. I begged this guy to come on the air, but he wouldn't want to come on the air. And he told me a story that I've got to share with you. It doesn't take place in Georgia, but it's so good that I've got to tell you about it. This guy was driving on a highway in Northern California. And I think it was Humboldt County, but don't quote me on that. I can't remember off the top of my head exactly which county it was. But now, this was not a back dirt road. It was a four-lane highway, two going south, two going north, with a big grass median in the middle, and then, you know, shoulders on each side of the road. And he sees what looks like a large, dark, hairy, just thing at this point on the shoulder. He's heading northward, so it's on his right-hand side, and he sees this dark, tall, dark, hairy thing on the shoulder acting like a crazy woman. Its arms are flailing in the air. It's making screaming noises, and it's making motions like it's lost, like it doesn't know where it's going. And he happens to notice that all the other cars in front of him are starting to hit their brake lights. So he's slowing down, hitting his brake lights, because obviously he doesn't want to hit somebody. And within about 10 to 15 seconds, he's almost even with this, we'll say, creature at this point. And he basically described what he saw was just this between seven and 8 feet tall, completely covered in dark hair, cone-shaped head, wide shoulders, the typical type of creature that, you know, you hear people describe. And what he did was he started to pull off on the shoulder to get a closer look, because he just couldn't comprehend what he was seeing. And his windows were rolled down. And when he did that, David, he said the creature started to motion towards his passenger side window that was open, yelled out this enormous scream, which made him throw his car into park, and he ducked down into the seat because he got so frightened so fast. And then after about 3 or 4 seconds, he looked up to see if the creature was still standing in front of his car. And he said he saw – he wasn't there. He glanced in his rearview mirror, and he saw the creature heading back up into the wood line. So the guy stays parked. This is where it gets really good. The guy stays parked on the side of the road for a solid 15 minutes. He's frightened. He's confused. He just can't figure out what the heck he was looking at and what he was seeing. So he did, after like 10, 15 minutes, he gathers himself. He calls 911. And the 911 operator says to him, or he says to the operator, he's like, listen, I have to report something that I just saw, but I'm afraid to describe what I'm seeing to you or what I just saw, because you may call the police on me and have me locked up as a crazy person. The 911 operator says, well, sir, tell me what your location is. So he gives this woman this highway and where he's roughly located on this highway. The 911 operator says to him, sir, don't feel bad. He says, 11 other people have just called in within the last 5 minutes describing the same thing that you just saw, and three of those people were off-duty cops.
Wow.
That's one of my favorite, probably one of my favorite encounters of all time. And I begged this guy to come on it, but he wouldn't do it. So, and I'm not going to share. He asked me not to use his name. So I'm not going to use his name either.
You know, I love these kind of stories, because everybody's heard the typical, I saw Bigfoot run across the road. It was 100 yards ahead of me. It was down on all fours. I could see it run across the road. I heard a howl. I saw a flash of fur in the forest. It was on 2 feet. Everybody's heard those stories before. But when you come across these rare stories, well, these things exhibit some very human-like, curious, extremely curious, and thought-provoking behavior. You have to ask yourself, what are they trying to tell us? You know, sometimes these things are pointing or motioning. And this thing waving their arms up over their head, trying to get your attention. Why would an animal that we all, you know, 90% of the time they're trying to escape our detection. They hide from us. They conceal themselves. Why on some of these rare occasions do they actually try to have themselves be seen, step out in front of people. But especially this kind of panic thing. I mean, that is so interesting. Why was it stopping cars? Why was it motioning to the passenger side of the car? I don't know. I mean, that is just. But what an interesting story. And you know, you try to get into this thing's mind. Why was it doing those things? And there's a reason for it. You know, we just don't know what it is. And that's probably where the story gets even more interesting.
Right. Yeah. So, David, let's get back to you now in the museum. First of all, for those of you that haven't been there, please go there. It is a fantastic place. David, I love your setup there. You have, you have pictures on the wall with biographies about regarding specific people that have been in this, studying this phenomenon for a long time, like, say, Dr. Jeff Meldrum and others that you've got. You have great visual exhibits. The one that really stood out was that Elkins Creek cast that you have. And for those of you who don't know, that's one of the more famous cases here in the state of Georgia, which was casted by a retired sheriff. So if you ever have a chance, look that up. I highly recommend it. I loved your larger exhibits, David, like, for example, the Ape Canyon incident. I love what you did with that.
Yeah, that was my favorite. That was the number one exhibit that I conceived in my mind, and it was probably one of the last ones I finished because there was so many pieces to it. And, as every week we add, I come across new items and artifacts that I add. So, like, even on days we're closed on Tuesdays, we're still working. We're standing something. We're making something. We're conceiving something. If we're not building it ourselves, we're designing it, and we send off to somebody else that can build it for us. I just continue to add and enhance existing exhibits. And we just brought out our brand new Tom Slick and the Hunt for the Abominable Snowman exhibit last week, and we'll probably formally unveil that this Saturday.
Oh, fantastic. That is truly excellent. I apologize for sounding repetitive, but for those of you out there listening that haven't been David's place yet, you really need to go. The visual, oh gosh, forgive me, but what's the word I'm looking for? I guess the amount of visual and information that you can gather by looking at what you've put together is so fantastic, and it's right there in front of your eyes, and it took my breath away. And I know I sound like I'm probably exaggerating a little bit, but I don't feel like I am, and I tell you, I don't feel like I'm exaggerating at all, because it is that good of a place that you've put together, David. I mean, I think I told you this when I met you. I've wanted to see something like this in Georgia for so long, and you've done such a great job, because I had mentioned to you there's a lot of other states, Arkansas, California, Texas, that've had these type of visual museum places for a long time, but we've never had one here in Georgia.
Yeah, and people ask me, you know, when they come into the museum, why here? Well, the number one reason is because we live here. And when we moved here 3 years ago, I kind of had it in the back of my mind about making a mobile museum that I could take to state fairs and expos and things like that. But the more I flesh this thing out, there just isn't a mobile home, an RV big enough to squeeze all the things, even just the important things in there. So as much as I wanted to do something on a mobile, smaller mobile kind of scale, I realized that I just couldn't get a machine big enough that I could safely drive around. So we moved up here. We built a small farm. I was working in town. I used to drive a semi over the road. And after we moved up here, we just fell in love with the whole idea of being so much closer to nature that I started tending bar in town up in Blue Ridge.
Mm-hmm.
And on my days off, we built a small farm. We have chickens and pig and turkeys and greenhouse and a garden. And we just realized as I was working in town in Blue Ridge, people would always come up and ask me, hey, I got my grandkids coming to visit this weekend. Would you have any suggestions as what we could do with them? Or people would say, hey, we're here for 4 days. We're meeting some friends up tomorrow. Would you have any suggestions? We could all go do something together. And every time somebody asked me that, I kept thinking, God, I really need to find out, you know, more some of the family attractions around here. And then I was surprised to really find out there really weren't any family attractions up here. We've got some nice places. We got Mercier's and some of the other big apple orchards, a few that are open year round. But there really wasn't anything for grandmother, son, daughter, and grandkids to all do together. And there were so many people already coming up here. The cabin rentals are just off the charts. Occupancy up here for all the cabins up here are almost full year round. I just kept thinking, man, why don't we just open up our own family attraction? And since my wife and I both are deep into Bigfoot, we just figured we'd mix the two together, kind of a Bigfoot and a family attraction together. We can't make it too scary, but it has to be authentic and it has to be real. It can't be hokey because it is a museum. And that's how we fleshed this whole thing out. It took us about 8 months, I guess, to do the sketches for each exhibit. And then, of course, most everything had to get purchased or made ahead of time, which we kept in the big storage storage place. So when we got the building, it was just a matter of 2.5-3 months to move everything in and paint and stain and carpet and get it done. And the work there never stops. Every day, every single day, we're in the middle of 3 or 4 different projects. I think that's the nice thing I think you have to keep it fresh. You can't just build it and then just sit back and collect money. You have to constantly add. So when people come back 3 months later, 4 months later, and I ask them, when were you here last? Oh, 3 months ago. Oh, my God, we've enhanced this exhibit. We've changed the movie up. We've added 2 more witness interviews. So it's just nice that when people come, it's not always the same. We're constantly improving and adding every single day.
That's awesome, David. As a matter of fact, you answered my next question, which was what led up to creating this museum. And you described that fantastic, how you were tending bar and then you learned that there really weren't that many much family attractions to take advantage of on the weekends. And then you coupled that with the fact that both you and your wife are passionate about this subject. And then you put your plan together and then you made it happen. Now, what was tougher, David? Was it tougher putting the exhibits together or actually obtaining the information for the exhibits, like the Elkins Creek cast and books and gathering information from eyewitnesses and whatever else, whatever exhibit you have on display, was it harder to get the information for that exhibit or that display, or just was it just building that display itself that was tougher?
I tell you something, you'd think it would be difficult to obtain the information and get mm-hmm. the people's information and the artifacts.
Yeah, that was my guess. Yeah, that was my guess, but go ahead.
Well, because everybody's so connected on Facebook, and almost all of my friends other than my family are Bigfoot people, and as I was fleshing these things out, as exhibits out, I would reach out there either through Georgia Bigfoot, Facebook, Bigfoot community. There's so many I belong to, so many Bigfoot groups that within, I would ask, does somebody have something like this? Or does somebody, or Jeff Meldrum, who was a huge help in collecting all of these the best of the best casts. So we have about, I guess, I don't know, 20 casts in there right now. We've actually obtained a few more through private collectors. But you think it would be difficult, but it wasn't as difficult to collect the artifacts, the cast, and the information from the people because everybody was so willing and happy to help out. That's why I love Bigfoot people. You'll never, ever meet a bunch of more fun people in your life. Man, if I'm going to go camping, I want to go with Bigfoot people. I don't think I've ever met a Bigfoot person that I did not like. And as I got into this Bigfoot thing with a Facebook, I it's really like elevated my whole thought on people, because I know there's a lot of bickering and fighting and all that. But once you get your close group of friends, 50, 60 friends, who they all kind of share your same thoughts on Bigfoot, there's never a dull moment in your life. You're always, going back and forth. People are submitting ideas and thoughts on the subject. And probably the hardest part was picking, not getting the information, but picking the best information. So there was so much stuff coming in that I had to put my brakes on and go, now, if I was a person that didn't know a lot about Bigfoot, but I was curious about it, and I came into the museum, what would I expect, or what I want to see that would hold my interest? So you have to take yourself out of the Bigfoot enthusiast shoes, and you have to put on your general public shoes. And that's what you have to do on every single exhibit that goes up. I don't think like a Bigfoot investigator or a guy that knows a lot about Bigfoot. I have to put myself, okay, I'm a guy that walks in the door. My brother-in-law is always talking about Bigfoot, and my wife dragged me here. What do I expect to see? And that is what I put on the walls. That's what I make my exhibits, because you have to approach that mind much different than you do of a person that absolutely knows that Bigfoot is real. Does that make any sense?
Oh, absolutely. And very well said. I was guess if I had to guess, I was going to guess that gathering the information would be harder than putting together the actual physical exhibit itself. But I'm glad I was wrong. it sounds like you said, you had to put the brakes on it and you kind of had to do some filtering.
You do. And you know what? A lot of people want to donate memorabilia. That seems to be the big thing. Hey, I've got some posters. I've got an old t-shirt. I got these neat stickers, but you know what? But you and I might think that stuff is pretty neat, but people that are paying money to go into a museum to learn something about Bigfoot, that would probably not hold their interest for more than just a millisecond. They would just glance over it because, we think it's kind of neat, but they don't really. So you really have to work harder to get the artifacts, to create the scene properly and authentically. So everything in there is authentic, or as darn close to authentic as we can get it. So I think that's probably the hardest part, is to make it as real and authentic as possible, and to stay away from the memorabilia kind of hokey side of it. It's easy to flip into that because people always want to donate that stuff, but because there's so much of it out there, probably. Go ahead.
I was going to say, you've done a great job of choosing what goes in there, because, as soon as I walked in there, David, I was captivated by what my eyes were seeing, which kind of leads me to my next question. Can you kind of expand on, you've got exhibits, you've got pictures, you've got say like an incident recreation, like with the Ape Canyon exhibit that you did. What else is there that people can feast their eyes on? Books, DVDs. You have a little mini theater in there as well. Can you run down a list of everything that you?
Well, we have the entryways always, because we owe so much to the people that came before us. Jeff Meldrum's still alive, but Jeff Meldrum, Gimlin, and Patterson, and Rene DeHeeden, and John Green, and Ray Crow, and there's so many guys out there that have come before us that really put themselves out on the line, stuck their necks out to investigate this thing, and that's what brought me along, because I read their books, I listened to their interviews, they were believable. So the first thing you see is a big wall of all of the guys I kind of grew up with, pictures of these expedition leaders as we have them. And it's kind of an ode to, hey, without you guys, this place wouldn't even be here. So there's about 35 different investigators. By all means, not everybody, but we have 35 probably of the most influential in my life investigators. And then we have a beautiful entryway that kind of sets you off on your own expedition. So you kind of get into the mind, hey, this is going to be an expedition of the mind of adventure. Get ready. And we have a nice little a welcoming video that lasts loose for every minute, letting you know what you can expect. And then the first exhibit, which we just put out there, is the Tom Slick expedition. We just it took us a couple 3 months to put this thing together, and it's got some of Tom Slick's artifacts. His family, his children live in Atlanta, and though he passed away in a plane crash, I think in the late 70s, all his expedition gear from the Himalayan Nepal expeditions were in boxes in their kids' basements in Atlanta. Excuse me. So when they heard about the museum, they called us up through the kindness of a nice fellow named Kevin Youngblood. I'm sorry, Youngberger, Kevin Youngberg. And he arranged for the Slick family to put all their father's expedition gear on loan to the museum for 2 years. And it was just all the original photographs, his diary, original Bluff Creek cast that had been broken half. I think two other Bigfoot casts, one of which is a copy, a Yeti Bigfoot track. There's just so much. It's just that's why it took so long to put this thing together. So that's the first thing you see is the Tom Slick expedition. Plus, there's a little slideshow of some of his best photographs from the expedition. And then we have a Native American display. With the great help of Kathy Strain from Washington. With her help, we put a beautiful Native American display there, explaining Bigfoot's been around here for a long time. Hmm. And we've got a full-size Florida and a full-size Georgia map, each one of them, I think, about 4 feet by 4 feet backlit. And you can actually see up on there at a glance where the reported Bigfoot sightings have been in both of those states. I think that's got a lot of impact on people because when you read a report and you read where it's at, it's a lot different than you looking at a map and you go, holy cow, I live right here. And there's a green peg over here, a yellow peg over here, a pink peg right here. So that's what I mean when you say, you can print a whole sequence DNA of a Bigfoot up there and in scientific language, tell exactly what a Bigfoot is and people will look at it and walk right by it.
Yeah, but you're not kidding about that. Yeah.
Yeah, they can't visualize it. And, of course, we have the theater showing a 17-minute movie called The Wild Man of Kentucky. And somebody was nice enough to share a two-minute short by a graphic illustrator named Trevor Jones with me. And it was made such an impact that I contacted the illustrator and asked for permission. And he granted it to us. So we add that to our theater. So we got a great little two-minute animated short. Along with 17-minute movie. We have Ron Moorhead's Sierra Sounds exhibit with a lot of his original photographs.
That's right. I forgot about that.
That records all the time. I'm getting ready to enhance that, as a matter of fact, with some videos he didn't have any videos, Ron, because I've been in contact with him for me to add to it. So, you know, of the actual site itself. But I'm going to add some of the videos of him describing their return back up there. Him and Scott Nelson, which is if you've never heard those, oh my God, are those mind blowing?
Yeah, I have, and they are. The one thing I'm trying to remember, was it Oregon or Washington State that they? Well, the Sierras are in
California.
Washington. Oh gosh, I had that wrong. I'm sorry.
Well, I think it was the Sierras in Northern California, because that's where he lives is in California.
Okay.
I'm not mistaken.
What's the mountain range that is a notorious hotspot that's just east of Seattle in Washington State? What's that mountain range called? Oh gosh. I would know.
Well, I know Gifford Pinchot. That's where I was at Expedition National Forest. But, you know, for a couple of East Coast guys, you know, I don't retain a lot of this stuff to my memory because I'm not out there all the time.
Gosh, you think I would know that off the top of my head, but you're right. We're both East Coast guys. So if I don't remember it, then forgive me.
Right. No, I'm just as bad sometimes.
And the reason why I bring it up is I thought Moorhead had done something out there in that mountain range east of Seattle, but I could be wrong on that. I'd have to double check. So.
Now you're not getting, you're not thinking about the Blue Mountains, are you?
No,
Walla Walla, okay.
No, not the Blue Mountains. Huh, okay, but anyway, now in addition to all that, those great exhibits, and by the way, that was very generous of you to show me that new exhibit that you were just talking about, the Tom Sills exhibit. Sills, is that right? Sills?
Slick.
Slick. Gosh.
Yeah.
Okay. Your host has bad short-term memory tonight. I'm sorry, everybody.
There's a lot to memorize. I mean, when you think about it, I don't know how I can keep the stuff in track. There's so much information. It's funny, too, because, Dan, isn't it funny when you talk to somebody that thinks this whole Bigfoot thing, you know, there's not enough evidence, and you almost look at him like incredulous, like, are you kidding me? I can't even keep track of how much evidence. There's so much out there, just tons and tons of it there. And people still have the audacity, these uneducated, and they're just not curious enough to look into it. They really think that there's nothing out there. And here you and I are in our, I'm 50, I'll be 55 next, actually in a couple of days. And I've been sucking this all in since I was 12. And there's so much that I know and so much that I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
And it can't be hard to keep track of the things I do know, and the audacity. Some people think, well, there's really no evidence or evidence out there, and you just think, oh my Lord, there's so much to it, and of course it's so dimensional.
That drives me crazy because, you and I have been studying this and reading about it, and doing everything that we could possibly imagine to fill our brains with information regarding this mystery, with information and from people and books ranging from Alaska to Florida and everything in between. And, if we can't remember one particular name here and there, then so be it. But the point is that and I'm just amplifying what you just said, is that if you just take the time to look at just a small piece of what we're talking about is convincing enough in most cases. But to get back to my first point, you were, for those of you that don't know, Mr. Beccaro was extremely generous to take me into this, the new Tom Slick exhibit before it was finished. And he was showing me all this great stuff that he was talking about, such as his diary and other artifacts. And, I tell you, that really blew my mind. I was like, wow, look at this stuff. I mean, it's like you could tell it's the old number two lead pencil on the diary paper and stuff like that,
Mm-hmm.
Fantastic stuff.
Yeah, but he was very into details. He was real meticulous about details. All his handwriting is, and you just don't, when you see his handwritten notes, there aren't any mistakes or scratches out or whiteouts. Guy was very level-headed and well said and well written. So as you flip through his diary, you think, oh my goodness, this guy really had his stuff together. He was no slouch. He was a very educated and smart man.
Fantastic. And there's other information that people can purchase from Expedition Bigfoot too, right? Like DVDs and movies and documentaries and books and stuff like that.
Oh yeah, I'll tell you, when we first opened up the museum, we had some T-shirts and some books. I think I had like five or six different books. Of course, almost all of my attention was going into the museum because I wanted it to be the best. Just really, really wanted the museum to be the best it could possibly be. And people would come in and ask me, "Do you have this movie? Do you have any? Do you have this book?" And I kept thinking, "Oh my God, these people are actually stopping in just to buy books and DVDs for their friends." I thought, holy smoke. So I had to slow down on the museum for about 2 months and really start to pay close attention to the gift shop. So we added probably another 10, 15 books to the lineup of books. So probably we offer about, I'm guessing about 20 different books right now. And probably around 10, no, probably closer to 15 DVDs, documentaries, movies. Yes, there's a lot more of them out there. I mean, I could sell 50 different DVDs, but each book I've read the book, or I have a lot of friends that have read the book, and it comes highly recommended. But each DVD I watch, and if it isn't family, if your whole family can't sit there and watch it with you, then I'm not selling it, because it's a family, and it's a family entertainment venue. We invite families in, and I'm just not going to have any. I'm not going to have any movies in there that that the whole family can't watch together. So, but all the documentaries, you know, we watched them, and we only put out good content, you know, useful, pertinent content. So
fantastic.
We had about 20 different DVDs too. And of course, t-shirts,
awesome.
and magnets and all that. We have quite a big gift shop.
You know, I've always wondered, I've always been curious, David, if take the big three, as I like to call it, the big three from the 70s, the Leonard Nimoy episode of Bigfoot, The Legend of Boggy Creek, and The Legend of Sasquatch, which is another movie that came out in 1977. And it was based loosely, and I emphasize very loosely, on a bunch of guys that went on an expedition and their campsite was rummaged and attacked by a series. It was almost like a late 70s version of the Ape Canyon incident. So for those of you listening, if you ever want to see it, it's on YouTube. Just put in The Legend of Sasquatch, 1977. But I've always wondered, David, and what's your opinion on this? Would those movies today touch young people who might have an interest in this as much as it touched you, me, and other guys that are around our age now?
I tell you something. I think they do, because, as a matter of fact, that legend, that the Sasquatch movie you were just referring to, you can watch that on YouTube. But they're all cut from a terrible, terrible, overly viewed VCR tape or something. They're so poor.
Yeah.
I reached out there and found a fella down in Florida who had a theatrical quality a copy of the movie, and we buy them from him. So if you ever want to see the best version of the Sasquatch, we sell it in the gift shop for like $9.50.
Oh, nice.
And you can watch it over and over again. Same thing with the Boggy Creek. We have the director's cut, which is enhanced, digitalized. The color's much better, vibrant, and the sound is way better. So, yeah. So if you ever want to watch those movies nice and clear the way you would see it in the theater, we have both those movies in the gift shop. And I think not only because the movies are good, but if you have good quality, kids are used to quality, used to digital movies, excellent special effects. If you try to sit them down in front of an old VCR style movie, they're going to lose interest pretty fast. It's just the quality. So you have to have the quality there. And I think those movies still are pertinent. We probably sold almost 200 copies of The Legend of Boggy Creek since we opened up.
Wow.
200 in 9 months. So it's reaching somebody, that's for sure.
Oh,
and,
gosh,
yeah,
I guess still, that answers my question.
yeah. We sell so many copies. And I think it would touch them. I really think it would. Unfortunately, I don't – you know, I almost want to say, I don't know if my sons, but there's just as many women, if not more women out there, young girls that are interested in this as there are men. So we have so many young kids come in, bring their notebooks and a pen and a paper. They're there to take notes. It's like school. And it really tickles my wife when we see those kids come in. So a lot of these kids, that fire has already been lit. And I don't know if it was a school project they saw or a movie they saw, but there are so many children that come in, they're already interested in Bigfoot. And they've been bugging their parents to bring them to that Bigfoot museum. And they always tell us,
great,
when they're waiting at the front of the desk, this kid right here, he's a big Bigfoot. We're here because he wanted to come. So The interest is already there, thanks.
Now, David, I've got to ask you a question that's a little bit on the darker side. I have interest in my listenership that talk about that they want to explore, or they want my show to explore further into the missing 411 series, and they also want me to go a little bit more into the mystery known as Dogman. As a matter of fact, I think it was two episodes ago, I had a fella from your area, as a matter of fact, come on my show and describe a couple of sightings that he's had that he can only describe. He's, you know, was very clear. These were not your typical Bigfoot looking creatures. These were the kind of creatures you hear described by, say, Linda Godfrey, who of course is famous for the Beast of Bray Road up there in Wisconsin. So my question is this, will Expedition Bigfoot, and if this is, you know, if it, regardless of whatever the answer is, if it may, or if it's, you know, if it may sound corny, but if it's top secret, that's okay too. Is there any expansion from Expedition Bigfoot into these two areas that my listeners have an interest in?
That is possible. Since we've opened up, we've had three Dogman reports come in. One in Pennsylvania, one in North Carolina. And I've been on the phone. People call us at the museum and share information with us. So there's a lot of things going on behind the scenes because I'm still an active investigator for Georgia. So there's a lot of things that are going on behind the scenes. When people come in, I'm either on the phone or I'm texting or Facebook with another witness. Mm-hmm. So it literally never stops. There's a fella that's been having some encounters that I've been going back and forth with that lives in Florida about some ongoing dogman activity. And as anybody that's ever seen one of these dogmen, they all say the same thing, that these things are not like Bigfoot. These things are very dangerous, and they're very fearful when they're around these things.
Mm-hmm.
And there's no gentle forest giant feeling, love, happy unicorn feeling when they're around these things. So,
right, yeah, you're right about that. You know what troubles me, David, is I got to be honest and upfront with you and all of you listening. I don't like discussing Dogman, and I tell you why. Maybe it's just the way my brain is wired, but when I discuss a cryptid like Bigfoot, my brain is usually playing connect the dots to the origins of these creatures, okay? But when I start to do connect the dots in my brain when it comes to Dogman, it's like Alice going down the hole and there's no end. And it really, at some mental level, it frightens me to no end that there is a creature like that out there. And there is no love lost between this creature and who or whatever runs into these things. And what worries me even more is the couple times that I've had a witness describe their encounter, I'm not too sure if you're familiar with Red Top Mountain, David, which is south of you. Same direction, just go down 75 and you'll hit it. But Red Top Mountain, he was describing a clear dogman-type creature. And Red Top Mountain is heavily, I can't emphasize this enough, it is heavily populated, not with residences, but every day of the week, there are hundreds of people either boating, fishing, hiking, camping, mountain biking, or kayaking. And I'm one of those guys who does most of that stuff in that area sometimes. And to think that there's one of those creatures on the same trail that I have visited, I mean, David, that just frightens the bejesus out of me.
That's probably one reason that the missing 411 series is so popular, because here you have this David Pelias is telling you, he's not telling you what it is, he's not telling you what's doing it, he's telling you what's going on, And if that isn't making you uncomfortable enough, then you add mm-hmm. these very sensible people coming in to telling you and telling me, look, I am telling you what I saw, man, and this thing was not a Bigfoot. It had a face not like a bear or a dog. It was 7.5-8 feet tall, built lean, tall, standing on two legs, but it wasn't huge. Like, it was wide. It was very tall, lean, but muscular. It had a face mm-hmm. on it like a dog, and it walked on 2 feet. And this guy you're telling, we all have a kind of a sense that when somebody is telling us the truth, especially people that tell us Bigfoot stories, you know, and you kind of have a sense when you meet and greet and talk to a lot of people, who's being honest with you, who's not looking at you in your eye, who's looking down, who's being vague, are they being overly descriptive, where they're, you know, making a big grandiose thing, or, you know, how comfortable they are. You have these meters, we have these little triggers, and when there's somebody in front of you telling you this and everything is screaming, this man is telling you the truth, he's uncomfortable, he's scared, it was broad daylight, he was with his brother when he saw it. Well, if he's telling you the truth, then these things must exist. So I think that is something that we have to embrace, is we have to just realize, man, not only are these things real out there, but they're showing up in places where they shouldn't be, because they should be on Red Top. Dog men should be. Well, how can there just be one? Because most people say they only see one at a time. We know if there's one, there has to be more than that. There has to
sure.
be a breeding population, which that's scary when you think and they're having babies. You know, and they said, I think that the equation has to be 3,500 to 10,000 Bigfoots to have a viable breeding population. Probably goes the same with Bigfoots or with dogmen. And Bigfoots, 3,500 to 10,000. So if you don't embrace that uncomfortableness and realize that there is way more going on around us than we can possibly imagine. It's not even just about Bigfoots anymore. It's there's a lot more going on around us. And until you embrace that and you really start looking, you might miss some very important things.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. And, you know, I mean, having an encounter with a Sasquatch is most of the time frightening in itself. But the whole dog man even goes to a new level, which is just, it's very, very unsettling. And like you just said ago, you know, getting back to my little catchphrase, let's start playing connect the dots. You know, I have said repeatedly on this show, David, that if Mr. Paulides was sitting in front of me and I was allowed to ask him one question, it would be this. I would say, Mr. Paulides, I completely understand and aware why you don't name a source for these strange disappearances. I'm also aware that what you do is that you show that the facts that you stick to show a high degree of strange and bizarre, which means, aren't we allowed to say that the source of that disappearance is just as strange and bizarre if the facts show that the disappearance of this hiker or this camper was strange and bizarre? That means the source is just as strange. No blood, no signs of a struggle, clothes on backwards, you know, whatever it may be. You know, hounds can't pick up a scent, no signs of an animal attack. You know, you're on the trail 30 seconds later, just because you're at the back of a group, all of a sudden you're gone, but there's no evidence of your disappearance. I mean, the whatever is causing that is just as strange as the disappearance in itself, which means, couldn't I say that, okay, so now I have to define what would be the what's defined as a strange source causing those disappearances? Well, we certainly can say Dogman is certainly one of those, and that's where my brain starts going a little hog wild when it plays connect the dots. I mean, you know, you could really, you know, have a barn burner inside your mind by saying, well, what else is bizarre? Well, aliens, Bigfoot, underground military bases conducting black op experiments. I mean, we could go on, and you keep going down the rabbit hole and there's no end to it. But if we isolate for strange and bizarre, like a dogman phenomenon, well, there's, like you just said a second ago, there's something to what David Paulides is writing, especially in those first four books that have to deal with the national parks and certain hiking trails and et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah, and I'll tell you some. If you would ask David, if you got him on your show and you would ask David Paulides, I tell you, in my opinion, what happened is he's not going to tell you. He has in his mind his own theory of what's going on, as I do, what's going on with Bigfoot. But you just can't tell people because it's so crazy that he's come to the conclusion that the smartest thing he can do is put the facts out there for you and then let you come up with your own answer that you can live with and sleep with.
That's right. Because he knows that if he was to name a source like you're saying, he would be backing himself in a corner, and that's the worst thing you could do.
Yep. Do you have proof of that? How can you say that? It's just like when a Bigfoot non-believer comes to the museum and expects me to try to explain to him in 5 minutes where Bigfoot's come from, where are they, how come they only see one of them, you know, convince me that Bigfoot's real. I wouldn't even bother, because you have to go see the evidence, and then read a few books, then come back and talk to me. Then we can have a conversation, because at least some of those things, the ice has been broken in your brain. And that's what he's doing with these books. He's a smart man. I'm sure he knows. Either he knows or he has a darn good idea what's going on. But if you just blurt it out, not only would his books not sell anymore, but people would label the guy as crazy. And only 5 or 10 years later from now, people go, man, this guy, he was on to something, you know, because I think some of these, when the movie comes out, we're going to have a pretty good idea as to what's going on back, you know, in the missing 401.
Right. Now, that's a great question. That's a great lead into a question, David, is I do know about the movie. Maybe you know more a little bit than I do. Is there a release date that you know of, or is there some speculation on when that might be coming out?
The last I heard was just about a week ago, was this going to be available the first half of 2017. I thought it was going to be available in January, but it looks like that's been pushed back a little bit. So, I'm hoping within the first quarter of 2017, the movie will be available. And I'll tell you, that's really going to be something. That might be one of the most disturbing documentaries made in the past 10 years.
Yeah, I agree, and it's going to be probably one of the most anticipated, because it's not just guys who are into Bigfoot like you and I. There's a whole generation of individuals studying strange phenomena across the board that want to take a look at this, take a look at what he's put together also.
Yep.
So, all right. So, for one last comment, and then we're gonna take the light off the darker side here. I want all of you to know out there, I will definitely be planning and working diligently. I want to get Linda Godfrey on the show. You know who Linda Godfrey is, right, David?
Oh, yes. I'd love to hear
her.
Yes.
Yeah. I'm going to, for everybody listening, I am going to be working extra hard to get her on the show. She's very, very nice, very intelligent. And from what I understand, she's always willing to do interviews, whether it be over the phone or on a podcast or whatever it may be. I mean, she certainly has made the rounds with the more popular, you know, shows that they're like Darkness Radio, Coast to Coast, and even Sasquatch Chronicles, one of my favorites. So, and of course, this all gets back to my original question, where you say there may be a possibility where this Dogman 411 information might be expanded into Expedition Bigfoot, and that's good enough for me. So let's go ahead and let's get off the dark stuff here. And I can't believe how much time we are already 1 hour and 5 minutes into the show. My goodness. So why don't we do this, David? It looks like we only have a few minutes left. So Is there anything you'd like to add about the museum and what it can offer to everybody? And also, and so it's one question into two parts. The second part is there anything coming down the pipe that you would also like to add for the listeners to hear about?
We are working on a little mini exhibit from a great cast, footprint cast we got out of Florida. And the story behind that is so amazing. Not only for a lot of these casts, if you can get the story behind the cast, sometimes it's a fresh cast and the people had seen it and it was doing unusual things. And then when you get the cast to go with it together, I think it makes more sense than just looking at a plaster cast. So we have a little mini exhibit coming out of Florida. And we're getting so many folks calling us at the museum. So I've been hard at work for the past couple of days making some long-duration recorders, audio recorders. I've got a witness over in Blue Ridge that's had some – him and his daughter and his wife have had some activity on their property. I think his daughter kind of pushed him to come in and share some things with us. He's found some bone piles and things are screaming and hollering out there from the back of the woods.
My
and,
goodness.
So we're going to start. We're upgrading our inventory of investigative material and tools, and we have thermal and parabolic dishes. We're making duration recorders, and we're upping our bank of cameras, game cameras. So, and of course, the conference room, we're going to be opening that up in mid-January. So we're going to start doing some Bigfoot conferences right here in Georgia.
That's awesome.
Yeah, we're really looking forward to that. So not only will we be doing conferences, we're going to be doing some really neat things that I think people like to know. How to operate a GPS, we'll be doing classes on that on the weekend. How to cast a footprint cast. What's the best way if you find a cast, how to cast it. How to track things. Wilderness survival and wilderness first aid. We've got some great folks, the Strobles down that live down in our Kennesaw. And they're going to show us if you're hiking with somebody and somebody breaks their leg and all you have is 6 feet of paracord and a small dull knife, how you can make a splint and get that person out of the woods. So on how to treat snake bites, venomous snake bites out in the woods if you don't have the proper thing. So we're going to be offering a lot of that stuff too. So
survival, that's great.
Oh, yeah, because you never know what's going to happen. What should you have in your backpack when you're out looking for Bigfoot, or what you have in your backpack, you're just going for a hike. And what are some of the things you're going to go camping on an expedition? What are some of the things you should have in your camping gear? And, what are some of the things that just waste space that you're probably never going to use? So, and then we're going to hopefully start doing some little mini excursions and expeditions ourselves, maybe in the spring or early summer. So I'll tell you, it's really, this whole thing is rolling so fast and it just keeps getting better every day, and every week we add more, come up with better ideas to engage the public, because the interest in it is way more than we ever thought it was going to be. We were so surprised at the all the people that came in and were interested in this and very excited to come in, that when they're excited, we get excited, and which just propels us to do even more for everybody.
Oh, that's awesome. And I tell you, the more you do, the more I look forward to it, because I will definitely be taking part, that's for sure. What was I going to say next? It almost sounds like, David, you've got so much coming in, and it almost sounds like you know how the BFRO has their own team of investigators. You may get to a point where you need your own little team of investigators.
Yeah, we just had that conversation day before yesterday, as a matter of fact. Yeah, with the conference room, when it opens up, we are going to have We have a big sign coming up. It's going to be a response and research center, Bigfoot Response and Research Center. So not only going to be able to do research there, we've got so many neat folks that live right up here in Georgia that either are current researchers or been doing this their whole life or kind of new to it. So we're going to have a core of about 10 to 15 folks that if something fresh comes in, there's not so much you can do with a 10 or 15 year old Bigfoot report or even, 2 months old, but something that comes in where it's ongoing activity on the property, we're going to have a team that's all situated somewhere within central to northern Georgia where we can respond.
Oh, that sounds great.
Yep.
All right, so it looks like we just have a couple minutes left. David, is there anything you'd like to add, how people want to anything you want to add as far as the museum, or if someone needs to contact you, how would that happen?
Well, there's a lot of folks reach us through our Facebook page, which is Expedition Bigfoot, or you can email me at D as in David, then my last name, B as in boy, AKARA at MSN.com. And our phone number, you can call me at the museum, and our phone number there is 706-946-2601. And you can reach, and we're open every day except for Tuesday. Even if you swing by sometimes on Tuesdays, we're there doing something. So, and if you know anybody that's got a Bigfoot report they want to tell us or they want to share with us, we update the Florida and Georgia maps once a month. So we take the report. Most folks that come in don't want us. It's in their yard maybe, or they saw it when they were hanging laundry out. So we're not going to be able to go to a lot of these folks' place because they're telling us they want to get it off their chest. But they don't want a whole lot of activity, people showing up in their backyard. So they just give us an idea where it happened. We'll be updating the map every month too.
Yeah, I understand what you're saying because, I have done my own investigations up there specifically in White County. And needless to say, I've spoken to a few people who had encounters on their properties, specifically in their backyard, and they asked me, listen, I don't want this place turning into a zoo. I don't want people coming around. So I don't mind telling you what happened, but let's just keep it between us. And of course, that's not a problem. I'm not going to expose that. But the point is, I completely understand what you're talking about when it comes to people who see these things on their property, but they want to keep that kind of on the, keep it between you and them, and they give it to you or they give it to someone like me so that we can talk about it because this is what we do, but we don't really want to go into detail too much as far as where where these people are having these incidents. I'll say the county. I've talked to three people who have had encounters on their property in White County, but that's as far as I'm going to go with that. So,
yep.
But David, I can't thank you enough. It's been a great show. One of the best. Not only has it been one of the best shows, but you've got one of the best things going up there. I will be back. I look forward to all the future stuff that we're going to be doing. And with your blessing and permission, I would love to have you back on the show sometime in the near future.
Yeah, and you make sure too, Dan. You got to come up and see that new Tom Slick. That new Tom Slick. Now it's all put together.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, I saw the pre exhibit.
Yeah, you should see it now. It's all sitting in a bed of snow, and it looks great. You'll be surprised.
Awesome. I promise. I will definitely make another trip up there, and you will see me. So I look forward to seeing that. David, thank you so much. It's been great having you to take the time to come on the show. I wish you nothing but the best, and I will see you soon.
Thanks, Dan. Hope to see you soon, pal.
Okay, you take care now. All right, ladies and gentlemen, that was Mr. David Bacara of Expedition Bigfoot, the museum in Cherry Log, Georgia. I highly, highly recommend that you go to there, go and visit there. I know I will be going again and again and again. So that's it for tonight. It's been a great show. It ran a little bit longer than normal, but hey, that's okay. When you've got a great guest and a great conversation going, that's what happens. So everybody, listen, have a great night. Stay safe. Treat your pets and animals good. And we will be talking again next week. You guys take care now. Bye-bye.
Thank you.